This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G. here along with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good, good. Good to hear your voice again.
All right. So this is our last show of the year of 2018.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, I don't know what means. But we've got a couple of questions today. We've got one left over from last week about shy men. And we've got a question from one of our listeners who is a self-described agreeable lady. Agreeable trader and has a what seems to be a disagreeable mate and trying to figure out the cost benefit analysis of staying with this mate and not staying with this mate. And then a very interesting question I want to hear your answer to about whether or not what a evolutionary psychology utopia would look like from Dr. Lyle's perspective.
Okay.
So
good.
We also have a caller who just called in on hold. So caller, we'll get to you. We'll get take a couple of questions, and then we'll get to you after that. So stay on hold. Dr. Lyle, you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, Dr. Lyle, men nowadays tend not to express interest in women in a clear but appropriate way. Particularly, the, quote, good guys have a tendency to hide their feelings. Do you think this hinders their chances? And would a more bold attitude be perceived as the product of better genes?
Well, we're going to start out with the opening phrase, which nowadays. So I always hear about nowadays, things are different than how they used to be, which is completely bogus. Things are pretty much the way they always were. So it isn't that nowadays some shy men are more careful about signaling their interest in females. They always were. So now the question would be, would bolder be better? The depends upon whether or not, you know, it depends upon the target women that are involved and whether or not they would happen to like that. Now, most of the time, that's probably true, but guess what? None of this makes any difference because that boldness is a product of your genetics. And so if you use that boldness by somehow, actually it's a big reason why alcohol is what makes the sexual casual mating worlds swing, is that it actually emboldens people by knocking down their anxiety. But if the guy isn't having a drink in the middle of work day and you're a female that he's interested in and he's on the shy, careful side, he's not going to get bold. And even if he goes to some seminar that tells him to be bold, he's still not going to be bold. The majority of relationships begin by women signaling to men that the women are interested in the men. And most relationships are going to start as a result of repeat exposure situations where people see each other over and again. And the female sees some of the inner beauty of the male. Then we have a trade dynamic where the male is very interested because he would feel like he's over-rewarded primarily in the attractiveness department. And then this thing can work out as the female can signal that she might be interested and the male can pick up that signal. So that's generally how you get a shy guy out of his tortoise shell. That's pretty much how that's going to happen. If you're a shy guy in your tortoise shell, I could say, hey, be bold, you know. Be bold and mighty forces will come to your aid. The point is that's not going to happen, okay? Because you're not that bold person, and this is unlikely to be a a strategy that you can turn on and turn off to any effect. So otherwise, learn to play the game within your shy parameters. This is why, by the way, God invented Match.com. Okay, this was the whole point. This is precisely what online dating applications are all about, is for men that would otherwise not have the courage to tap on a woman's shoulder, now can tap on a woman's shoulder and potentially get a hearing of about a minute and a half, about the length of time it takes for her to read his profile. We know that from the research evidence that women will read the men's profiles, provided it isn't too, the photography and the delta between the two of them isn't too outrageous. The women will read the profile, so the guy actually gets to do his pitch. So he gets about a minute or a minute to 2 minutes of her time. And if he can make a pitch that gets a tiny little hook in her mouth, then good for him. He probably won't, but he might. And so that's better than nothing, which is nothing is what he's going to get everywhere else. So, yeah, this game of the bold is the reason why bold is probably useful in this arena is a great deal of boldness comes as a result of confidence. So a great deal of confidence comes as a result of perceived probability of success. And the perceived probability of success comes as a result of successful history. So people that are bold are usually people that have had a lot of success. And I'll give you like one guess as to why, okay? It's because they're highly attractive people. And they're highly attractive people that have a fair amount of testosterone in them. And they probably highly attractive people with a lot of testosterone and some alcohol. Now you got the guy that has got some success in the bar. So anybody else playing this game, yeah, good luck to you. Will you have some success? Sure. If you're a five in the bar and you have a lot of boldness and you've got some alcohol in you, you got a shot at, you know, somebody in your territory, maybe even a little above. That boldness might pay a little bit. But, you know, what does this have to do with anything? We're talking here ultimately about essentially boldness behind casual mating strategy, probably. And you know that's its own game. There's many strategies one could use for casual mating strategy. All kinds of pseudo esteem cues, clothes, car, money, you know, lavish spending, all kinds of things can add to that your ability to play in that arena. But if we're talking about trying to find an actual good pairing, then the real strategy is to find a place where you can have some kind of possibility to expose who it is that you actually are, and then just be yourself. That's the best move there is.
That's fascinating, because I always, I mean, you've said in this podcast many times that agreeability is kind of a big factor in relationships, and yet when you're bold, you're essentially demonstrating disagreeability.
Right.
And so it's always interesting. I've heard people say, well, you got, like you said, you got to be bold and you got to do this and you got to, you know, essentially bluff
right.
a little bit of disagreeability. And so,
right.
yeah, it seems like it's more of a casual mating strategy.
Yes.
A casual mating strategy versus anything else.
No question. In other words, if you do that, shoot yourself up with some testosterone, knock down some alcohol, if it's not part of your nature. And then you may be able to display essentially more disagreeability, and therefore, by implication, a greater track history of success with women at that attractiveness level. And as a result, what you're doing is you are doing a very subtle fish trick. You're essentially demonstrating that you've had success with people at that level often, and you would expect to be successful in the present. And so, you know, this isn't going to have that much latitude. We know that it doesn't. The dream of, you know, the pickup artist and these sort of hacks that are going to pretend like they've got the secret to the universe behind some really rudimentary understanding of evolutionary psychology, there's no great success here at all. So there's The are there? Is there a little bit? Yeah, probably. Is there very much? No. You're not going to turn a five into a successful farmer of seven and eight females. This is never going to happen. You may turn him into a successful farmer of six females, particularly if that female is sufficiently inebriated. All right.
Well, I've talked to a few women who have actually said that they get extremely turned on when a male displays his disagreeability in these type of situations.
Right.
And I can only guess that it's the fantasy of, you know, being on alpha side. Is there anything to that?
Oh, I'm sure that's true. In other words, but remember, it's not all females. So not all females actually bite on that. And so the we're talking about and it's also the case that if you're thinking about, for example, I don't know why we're thinking about a bar scene, but that's sort of the ultimate, you know, pickup joint for casual mating. And so if we're thinking about that scene, remember the women that are there and mean business. We know who means business. They will show more square inches of their skin when they're fertile. So in other words, they could be there unconsciously looking to have a higher probability of casual mating given the time of the month. And that being the case, it's also the case that we know that when women are in their most fertile phase, they are seeking the male that is the most dominant for relative to their personal preferences. In other words, that is the moment when they are most susceptible to casual mating, you know, opportunity. And so we know what they're seeking. We can tell, the scientific evidence clearly displays that they are seeking dominance. They're seeking rough edge dominance out of the male rather than cooperative and pleasant. Okay. So now let's just think about this. So there's some girl you're trying to hit on at the office. The truth is that when it comes to seeking a long-term mate, she's not seeking some dominant alpha male. That's not in the middle of her bell curve for what it is that she would be most interested in. Now, is it true that, you know, she might get a little weak in the knees a few times at the bar at just the right time of the month, and somebody with a lot of arrogance and push might actually get home? Yeah, okay. But that would be a lousy strategy if you are looking to pair bond with that female. And you're working at that office, you don't need to display those characteristics. You need to be yourself and find out if who it is that you are actually matches her actual preferences. So her actual mating preferences are dynamic. They're not static. So most women, most of the time, are not openly interested in the most dominant, aggressive, disagreeable male. Okay? The fact that they the fact that the peak of their interest in such males, it's with some latitude of acceptance, happens to be when they're the most fertile and they're therefore most susceptible to casual mating strategy. That is true. But let's remember that that's, you know, 10% of the time. And so if you're very interested in casual mating, if I made a career out of casual mating, you know, I would, you know, channel my inner Trump, okay? Be disagreeable and bold as hell and just see how many things I could knock over. but that's exactly one personality characteristic. And so it's going to turn out that women are generally not making the majority of their mating decisions based on those characteristics. Some women will, because they happen to, you know, that is their unique personality, that they happen to value that. But a hell of a lot of women don't. So that's why I say, you know, rather than try to game the system, better to just do a really good competitive job of being who you are and call it a day.
Fascinating. I love it. I'm reminded of the time on the show where you said that that for the women who tell you, oh, yeah, you should be a little more disagreeable, you go, oh, well, find the brute. That's not me.
Yeah, that's it. All right.
All right.
What else we got?
Our next question. Dr. Lyle, I've heard your advice before for people to, quote, not build their lives around a disagreeable narcissist. And it got me wondering about my own life. I'm 22 years old, very agreeable, and I'm in a relationship with a 22-year-old male who's highly disagreeable. We met 10 months ago and have been living together for 4 months, and for the most part, we're happy. But he can be difficult at times and often acts very entitled, yet also makes great efforts to go more than halfway with me and make the relationship a great experience for both, because he says he loves me and wants to marry me, and this has me torn. If I remember correctly, I think you said it's rare for agreeable people to get out of relationships with disagreeable people. And if this is a bad thing for me, I don't want to stay when I could have been better off somewhere else. As far as marriage goes, it's not something that I'm interested in, especially so young. But in terms of a relationship with this man, do I get out now and find myself a more even trader? Or if I choose not to, are there any common problems I could face or scenarios that could be played out as a result of spending my life with a person like this? As a fellow OCD, I can relate to this question. This is a great question.
Get out. All right. Let's look at this. It sounds like it is a very agreeable person who is doesn't take a lot of positives in a relationship to kind of hit the happy circuit. So this person has a great capacity for happiness, and all they need is a halfway decent trader. The last thing they need is a very disagreeable human. This is a recipe for trouble. So what I would say is get some distance. Okay, for God's sake, you're 22, you move in with somebody, big mistake. Don't do it. Okay? So if you're already in there with somebody and you're moved in, and now we you know, are facing this sort of disagreeable, problematic human, no matter how positive this thing is, obviously there's a lot of negatives, or the person wouldn't be having all these kinds of second thoughts, all kinds of consternation about this. The right decision is get some distance. And this is an example of never make a big decision when a small decision will do. And we can also look at decisions that we don't have to make them. So I think one of the things that happens when people move in together, this is a mistake that I made when I was about that age. So I thought I was very grown up and mature and intelligent and like I knew what I was doing. Oh, man. So I moved in with this very, very fine person, and that was the first mistake, big one. Okay, so now when it turns out that a while later I'm wanting out of the relationship, now it's really uncomfortable, because now you've set up everything, you played house, you pretended to the world like you're a couple, and everybody sees you that way. You've actually got your lives now organized together in a unit. This is a mistake. You want your own space. You want your own space because the time when you want to get out, you don't want to have a bunch of channel factors or a bunch of obstacles for you to get out. Okay, so what I had is I had a whole host of obstacles that get put up in the way, you know, you're going to have to find another place. So now it has to be a thought out, you know, resistant process that essentially stands up to all the pleading and all the determined, you know, push from the other side, all the social censure and pressure that might come. Like, this is a fiasco. And so it's going to trap agreeable people into long-term relationships in the same way it trapped me. And this is not unique. So this person's in a situation where they're very likely to be trapped into this thing unless they make a concerted effort to get out. So what I would say is you don't have to get out of the relationship, but you got to get out of the apartment. So if it's such a great idea to be together, it'll be such a great idea when you're living in two different places. Oh, well, what about the money? Best money you ever spent. The best money you ever spent is the money that it takes to live on your own in your own space. Yeah, you don't want to have your finances intermingled at 22 years old, can't comfortably and responsibly live on your own because we've got, you know, this entire two lives intermingled as far as that goes. This is a disaster. You want to be independent with your own space. And you move in with somebody under a couple of conditions. Number one, you really like them. You're over 30. In other words, there's some just pulling your leg there. You got to have a lot of good reasons. You got to really know that you've got the chops to get out, both financially and psychologically, that you've got the chops to get out, you know, quickly, conveniently, elegantly, and easily if you need to. If it's in your best interest. Way better to have your own space. You can always move in together later. No rush. Give that relationship a couple of years. Then you can do this. Now, I know people will roll their eyeballs, but I'm telling you, for everyone that's worked out just dandy, there's 40 that didn't, where somebody got trapped and it was a mess and didn't get out and stayed in there for 7 years before they managed to finally be so frustrated and miserable that they finally somehow summed up the gumption and chewed through the straps. So that's my solution to this, is that this is such a great relationship. It'll be a great relationship where the two of you have your own separate little apartments a mile apart. What's the problem? The only problem is financial, and by God, you have to face that problem or you got to go live with your mother. One way or the other, you don't get your finances intermingled around a real estate decision where you're sharing space with somebody that early that you don't know that well. That's a mistake. And that's a mistake this person, if this person manages to get out of this, it's a mistake I hope she doesn't repeat. All right.
Fantastic. All right. Well, speaking of utopias.
Yes.
Excuse me. Yep. All right. Speaking of utopias, Dr. Lyle, do you believe in some sort of utopia that humanity might get to in the future? The follow-up question is, do you think that our major conflicts in the world are primarily caused by the narcissism of our leaders?
There's a lot of problem caused by narcissistic leaders, not in democratic situations, but in there's plenty of problems with, you know, narcissistic climbing thugs that have gotten to the head of dictatorships around the world, and these are dangerous people that impoverish all kinds of people and are up to, you know, a lot of trouble. So the narcissist in a democracy gets voted out. You know, they're only there for a limited time. They've got checks and balances all over their behavior. So the government essentially from 1 year to the next looks an awful lot the same in terms of its functions when you're looking at a democracy like the U.S. or Great Britain or all over the place where people live in a civilized way. So there is an issue with the big time danger of narcissists in the as rulers around the world. That's true. Now, there isn't going to be any utopia in the future because we're not getting rid of the disagreeability in humans. So utopia is some notion that you're going to live in a place with this, you know, essentially super minimized conflict. I don't think so. Not in the next 500 to 1,000 years. I would find that to be unlikely to be the case. There's going to be trouble. Now, however, that being the case, it isn't the leadership that is the big problem. It's whether or not you manage to have a political system evolve that is based on human freedoms and human rights like the United States. So within the United States, you can look at this thing becoming more and more of a utopia with every decade that passes. So as the country gets wealthier and people get more and more power over their own lives and have to spend less and less of it, you know, making shoelaces and turning burgers when they don't want to, you get and staying in relationships that they don't want to be in behind financial issues. You are freeing people to have them, you know, change their choices, move on from things that they don't like, basically to try to find themselves in circumstances of what they're doing and who they're doing it with that they like a lot better. And that is massively more possible now than it was in 1945. It's not even close, okay? So it's going to be vastly better 100 years from now. So I wouldn't call that a utopia, but I call it just a better and better and better place to live. Now, so that being aside, the most important thing in all this is not to be worried about some utopia that's out there in the future where everything could all be worked out and we don't have any conflicts of interest and everything's great. That's not going to happen. You're going to have disagreeable SOBs that are going to misinterpret what it is that you said or willfully misinterpret or trick you into contracts. And there's going to be civil law and lawyers and et cetera. There's going to be trouble. And there's going to be trouble internationally behind knuckle-dragging narcissists in the world's capitals that think that they're going to intimidate free people and to get more of what it is that they want. So that's going to happen. But what's important for you, that'll be pretty well taken care of, and hopefully very few Americans will lose their lives behind this. The real issue is to build your own life and to your own personal utopia is the personal utopia of the interaction that you have with others. And so this is possible now. What's possible now is to look at your life and think about who it is that you are and who it is that you like, and look at the people that you're interacting with and ask yourself whether you really like these people and you like interacting with them. And to the extent that the answer is no, then you don't have a personal utopia. And to the extent that the answer is yes, then you do. And because the vast majority of everything that's important to your life is the esteem signals that you receive from other people in your interactions with mates, friends, and trading partners, it is, it's literally within your power to largely define who it is that this is going to be. Now, not completely. So if you are a person of limited means and limited abilities and you have to work for people that you don't particularly like because that's the situation, then you're not going to have an ideal situation in that regard. Now, you can aim to make it better, and you can look to find out, what you can do in terms of your knowledge and skill development and what the choices are in the marketplace. So I wouldn't suffer a lousy work situation for very long before I was looking for something that looked like it was better. With friendships, definitely you don't have to be putting up with friends that you don't like. You can rescind those relationships anytime you want. And once again, we'd want to be looking for people that we have a lot in common with, that we like, and we would like to make those our friends and go through processes of investing time and energy in ways that we enjoy as we build bonds with people that we like and we fire the people that we don't like. The same thing is true in romances. Okay, so there's nothing exalted or admirable about people being frustrated and miserable for 50 years and having a gold wedding anniversary. You got to be kidding me. Okay, they should be penalized for doing such a thing. They are penalized, actually, plenty enough as it is. But we shouldn't be exalting this or cheering it. Okay, the question is, or intimidating anybody out of deciding that they're not going to do it. The issue is, how happy are you? And if you're not very happy, you don't have your personal utopia. Your personal utopia is to try to build a set of relationships and a life interacting with other people that consistently causes you a lot of moods of happiness. That's what you want. You don't need the government to be right. You don't need the narcissist to be disempowered. You don't need anything. We don't need 1,000 years of human development to manufacture some shining city on a hill. You don't need any of it. You've got enough right now, okay? And how far you get to taking your life from what could be a 5 or a 6 up to a 7 or an 8 in terms of enjoyment, or from a 7 or an 8 to a 9 or a 10, this all depends upon how much effort and how much good fortune you have as you look at the relationships that you have in your life and say, wait a minute, that one just doesn't cause me that much happiness, and it causes me a lot of stress and anger and irritation and frustration. Well, then we better figure out how it is that we're going to dial that one back close to 0. If it's your mother-in-law, then, we might have to dial it back to 3%. So you may have to pay some prices because some of these people may be attached to other people that are more important. So we may need to, but we may need to be doing some compromising. But I have to tell you that compromising for me is really minimal. Okay, so I don't put up with it very much. Whatever that relationship is that's so important that I have to kowtow to somebody for something, boy, there better be something really important on the other end of that, and there be a damn good reason why I'm going to let some disagreeable person that I don't like into my life for very much percentage of it. Truth is that you've got 100,000 hours left, maybe. That's more or less what I've got left. And so my personal utopia is about building a social existence around myself that those 100,000 hours are spent doing the things that I enjoy doing with the people I really love. That's it. Okay? And I don't need any magic for that to happen. I just need some self-discipline and some effort and sometimes some hassle that I have to jump through the hoops to get those things, get those situations created. But that is the goal, is a monitoring device for looking at your own happiness and being unwilling to tolerate, you know, sort of chronic lousy with respect to any major players in your life. You want to put together a golden team. That's the promise of any utopia, is a golden team for your life, really find people that you like and you do things with them. That's how to get this thing done. And it comes from respecting the fact that your personality and their personalities are genetic. They are fixed. You're not going to change them. You're not going to change them 1%. And you're not personally going to change 1%. So don't wear yourself out trying to, quote, make your relationship work. That's a total waste of time. Okay? That relationship either has excellence inside of it or it doesn't. And if it does, if you don't have the patience and maturity to work through the conflicts, then, you know, call somebody like myself who does, and I'll help you do it. It won't be that hard. But if what's at the root of the relationship are personality conflicts that are causing a lot of discomfort in those two people's lives, those are never going to go away. And those people aren't going to be part of any positive side of any personal utopia. So it's the steps here are figuring out who you are and what is that you want, figuring out who they are and whether or not they fit. And if the answer is no, don't put them on your team unless you desperately need somebody in your team. You need somebody to play shortstop, and maybe you got to put somebody in there, okay? Got to drag a bum off the street to be your best man at your wedding, call it good. But the bottom line is that you want people in this game that you really like. Okay, that's who you want to play with, because the interactions that you have will be the determining factor of ultimately the overall quality of your life experience.
Wow.
All right.
Excellent. Dr. Lyle, we've got two callers on hold, so we're going to take our first caller, who's been here from the beginning of the show. Caller, what's your name? Where are you calling from?
Lita.
I can't hear.
Oregon.
What's that? Hello?
Lita from Bend. Hello. Lita from
okay.
Bend.
Okay. Lita,
where
Lita
are you
from? Lita, if you can turn off your speaker and just go straight to your phone.
Yeah.
There we go.
Hi, Lita. And where are you from?
Bend, Oregon.
Bend, Oregon. All right. Very good. My sister and I broke down in Bend, Oregon, and had to replace a water pump. And that's how we barely made it out of there. All right. We're about 16 years old. Tell me a story. What are you working on, and what are we trying to get better?
Well, actually, I have a question. I've heard you reference 10 paid dates, which mm-hmm. I'm guessing must be from dating guidelines that you have or espouse or have thought about. And I was mm-hmm. hoping that you could talk about that.
Sure.
Or whatever dating guidelines for women that you have.
Yeah. Yeah, 10 paid dates is sort of a standard guideline that I use. And what this is and why it is that I recommend it is as follows. The reason is that the male and female have different mating. Incidentally, I made it up. I haven't seen it anywhere. This is my creation. It certainly goes back a long ways. It's not like other people haven't talked about similar things. But 10 paid dates is sort of my unique perspective. Now, why? The reason is What I'm trying to stop is the following. I'm trying to stop females from getting into relationships with guys and then getting dumped a month later and being all heartbroken. This is going to be a fairly common process, and it's a process that is significantly avoidable, and the time and energy associated with these relationships can be fairly expensive. The reasons why this is happening, why human relationships in the mating arena are problematic, is that human beings find themselves in the middle of a continuum behind a He-Man species and a Parabon species. So He-Man species is where a few males do all of the mating and all of the females mate with just a few males. This is true throughout the vast majority of the animal kingdom. Basically, females have in their heads a very sensitive cues for male sexual attractiveness, and all the females agree as to who's the sexiest guy, and then all the females mate with the sexy guy. And the sexy guy doesn't do anything else, doesn't provide any other resources for the female. It's just he's just a sperm donor. It turns out that this is the most successful strategy in nature for the reproduction of DNA. And so it's almost exclusive in the animal kingdom. However, a few small percentage of animals don't do it this way. So by hook or by crook, across a few different novel evolutionary problems, you have incidentally, in those species, there's no such thing as males. The males don't have any detection cues for beauty in females. Every female is a 10. They're completely acceptable. So all females mate, and only maybe 2 or 3 or 4% of males mate. So in nature, almost all males go to their graves without ever having mated once. That's just the standard operating procedure in nature. On the other side of the continuum, you have a Parabon species. This is where male and female equally invest vigorously in providing for offspring. So this is going to be characteristic of about 3% of mammals. Quite a few birds will do this. This is another strategy. And human beings find themselves somewhere in the middle. So humans are caught between the He-Man strategy and the Parabon strategy. Now, the He-Man strategy, the females get weak in the knees, mate with males that are really fancy, and the males have no intention of investing anything in the female and her offspring. In a Parabon strategy, the males are so enamored with the female that they're intending to stick around, quote, forever and invest heavily in offspring. So if you're a female, it pays to know what strategy it is that you're sort of seeking. So if you're seeking a He-Man quality casual mating for the excitement of that, no problem. 10 paid dates doesn't make any sense. Go ahead, and there's no reason to not get knocked over on date one. And if a person enjoys that process, no harm done. However, what's typical is that females aren't wild about that process. So females are usually wanting to have a process where they're in a, quote, relationship that means something, where the male cares about them specifically. In other words, they want Parabon psychology. And so because this is true, human males and females have evolved different mating strategies to deal with the problems of trying to essentially maximize their rate of return on their resources around sexuality. So what females will do is that they will try to pick males who are acting like that they are very interested in them and would stick around long term. The males are designed by nature to bluff the females by acting like they're going to stick around long term, but really not. So the males have evolved to not only do that consciously when they know quite well they're not interested in the female long term, but pretend that they're interested. But worse yet, the male has also been evolved to bluff himself, because the best liar is somebody that believes their own press clipping. So it turns out that males will believe that they're really interested in a female, but it turns out they're not. And they discover that they're not just about the time that they may have taken a good shot at getting her pregnant, which is maybe sometime in the first 90 days of relationship, where he's had three cycles to try to impregnate her. This is all predicated on understanding that the psychology of humans hasn't changed fundamentally since the Stone Age. So it doesn't matter when you use birth control or not. That's not influencing anybody's decision making. When it comes to their preferences and their hearts, what's going to happen is if the female gives the male access repeatedly for 2 or 3 months, female's likely to feel pretty attached and feel like the reason why this is happening is that because, you know, she values him and he values her, and she's thinking that she's got long-term resource flow coming to some unborn child. The male is designed apparently to come out of the ether after a couple, 3 months, and to just discover that he didn't love her that much after all, even though he said all those wonderful flowery things 10 weeks ago. Okay. So now we have a heartbroken female, all upset, twisted up, and has wasted 3 months of her life looking for a parabon and got burned again. So what's the solution to the problem? Well, the solution to the problem is 10 paid dates. So the notion is we make the male actually pay real live money because he's got to go earn it. Okay. And then it takes his time, and then it turns out that he can't get into her pants on date one, can't get there on date two, can't get there on date three. And then I hear the women say, oh, my God, but if you don't go at date three, then you're going to get rejected. Not by a parabonder. Never. Not by somebody that actually feels like you're of sufficient gene quality that they can picture the possibility that they would want to be around for a long time. Not a chance in hell. Parabonder never walks away after the third date. When he didn't get any sex, not a chance. Only a casual mating strategy player that knows he's a casual mating strategy player would walk away frustrated and irritated and, hey, what's the problem, babe? Okay? So on date four, what's going to happen? Same thing, just a little more determined casual mating strategy player. Will a pair bonder be upset? Nope. How about date five? Nope. Six? Nope. Seven, nope. Okay? What's actually happening is the pair bonder is getting signal to the female that although she's interested, it's not easy to knock her over, which is actually signaling that when he's away on a hunt sometime 2 years from now, that when he's gone, she's not going to be sleeping with somebody else. Not very likely that she actually defends the eggs pretty carefully. So this tells him that she's a good investment, and so this is a perfectly solid signal to send. No reason not to send it. Now, let's suppose that this goes on. There's been a couple dates a week for about a month, and now there's 8 dates, and no, there's been no sex. Oh, you can make out with the guy, but nope, haven't gotten there. Under those conditions, you might say, hey, 3 weeks in, there's just no way this guy's going to put up with us. He will if he's a pair bonder. And he won't if he's suddenly discovering that, you know what, I'm just not that hot on her after all. What we've done is we've made it possible for the man who has got self-delusional fascination with the female and essentially a bogus chip has gone off in his head that is acting out a high level of interest, which he would not ultimately have. That system is a self-delusional mechanism in order to help him bluff the female into getting to her sexuality, okay? That's what we are attempting to smoke out. So we, by 10 paid dates, we will smoke out a huge percentage of conscious casual mating strategy players within 3 or 4 dates. Those we get rid of right away, and that's a lot of people, okay? But then we get out some more. By stretching this thing out and withholding, no problem. We smoke out a bunch more people that are actually self-delusional casual mating strategy players. 10 dates in, you know, what's been the cost of this? Gee, I really wanted to sleep with him. He was really cute and I was really into him. So starting date 6, when you really thought it was reasonable and you really liked him, that we still shut the door on that. Not a problem. So people go without sex, 6th date, 7th date, 8th date, 9th date, 10th date. Like this is a big crisis. Okay, the value of such a strategy is that we save ourselves the process of getting into a sticky wicket we're in an intermediate term, short-term mating strategy that we were hoping was a long-term strategy but wasn't. And then the male walks away, takes basically 3 months' worth of eggs, exits, wasn't interested, and now we burn 3 months of our lives when we're trying to look for Mr. Right, possibly under a time clock of expiring eggs. So this is why 10 paid dates is a useful strategy. I'm not saying it's the right strategy for everybody under all circumstances, but as a general rule of thumb, I keep returning to this over and over again with women that have been burned, frustrated, and are at the end of their rope with these surprisingly deft strategies of the male. Those deft strategies of the male have evolved under the last 2 million years to bluff females out of their sexuality. They're good at it. So this is a conscious strategy to essentially put some barriers up to protect yourself. Does that make sense?
I don't mean to be glib, but I'm just wondering if you're referring to just 10 dates, not necessarily, because in the modern dating arena, after 10 dates, I mean, it's not... I think you're just referring to 10 dates, whether or not the woman pays half at some point, just 10 dates with no sex.
Yeah, and I would say 10 paid dates where the guy pays something, okay, because we want to, I don't really care. This is just a general rule of thumb that, if we're taking little hikes, that didn't count. He didn't pay anything. Okay. This we want to see.
So you're saying you're actually putting a psychological substantive value on the fact that the man is paying.
Yes, I am. Well said. Absolutely. We want him to be signaling that he is completely enamored enough with this female that he wants to signal that he would provision her indefinitely. If he's not willing to open her wallet, his wallet to provision her and to impress her with the fact that he's willing to do that, he's not that interested. And you should have your eyes wide open if he's actually trying to be cheap about that process in the early courtship process. If he's actually putting his hand over his wallet and trying to cheap it out, that's a major signal of casual mating strategy play. That's precisely how we would expect a casual mating strategy circuit to work. How can I get to the sex as cheaply and easily as possible? Whereas with a parabonder, that is not what the strategy is. Okay? So this is precisely why it's called 10 paid dates and not 10 dates. And that is absolutely substantive. Good question. Very good.
Great. Thank you so much for the call.
Very good.
We really appreciate that. We've got a second caller who's been on hold for about 40 minutes, Dr. Luck. We
sure.
Take one more caller?
You bet. Let's do it.
Caller, thank you for staying on hold. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Yeah, my name is Scott, and I'm currently in Winter Haven, California.
Very good. Winter Haven, California. Is that down the Palm Springs direction?
Actually, it's about 20 miles west of Yuma, Arizona. So I'm down by the border of California, Arizona, and Mexico.
Very cool. All right. Well, you actually got some nice weather down there, even in the winter.
Yeah, certainly. And that's exactly why I'm here.
Very good. All right, Scott, what can we do for you? What's up?
Well, my question has to do with attention, memory, and aging.
Okay.
I'm 62 years old, and I've noticed over a period of time that my memory hasn't been as good as it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
But back in 2012, I changed the way I ate, and I eat a whole food, plant-based diet. And I have noticed over a period of time that my memory's better, but I can also say that I feel like I'm attending to something that I want to remember. For example, if I'm meeting somebody, earlier in my life, they would come and introduce themselves, and I'd be more interested in remembering what my name was so I could tell them, you know, mm-hmm. the kind of thing. But now it seems like I remember somebody's name when they mention it, and I'm attending to it, and I can remember their name for several days and stuff mm-hmm. like that. So my question is could aging affect attention to something, or does aging affect memory, or is it both?
Well, I think that what's going to affect attention is going to be cost-benefit analysis. So attention is so aging isn't going to affect attention. Aging is going. I mean, your life circumstances as they change will shift what you're attending to, and you don't really have any choice of what you're attending to. Your mind is running deep cost-benefit algorithms to try to figure out what you should be paying attention to. So
okay.
when you're young and just learning to drive, you're paying attention to the clutch and how it works. Once you know how to do it well, you don't attend to it. And so so that's how that works. Now memory certainly is under the way a living thing is built, an animal is built, is it's going to have a peak where it functions beautifully. There's going to be a period of time when it's at its apex, and then after that, it's going to decline. And so it's going to be the case that your kidneys at 40 aren't what they were at 30, and your kidneys at 60 aren't what they were at 40. And this is going to be how it's going to work. Now, amazingly enough, the human mind appears to be pretty resilient to that deterioration. More so than what we typically see with the rest of the organ systems. So, there's maybe some evolutionary sense as to why that would be the case. But eventually, there's going to be some decline. But the decline that we've observed, certainly in the Western world, may not be consistent with the actual evolutionary history and natural architecture of human cognitive decline, because the diets are lousy. People are having all kinds of little mini strokes as a result of their poor dietary histories. They're using a lot of dietary drugs, coffee and alcohol, et cetera, cigarettes. Things are beating up the brain tissue specifically. They don't exercise very much. That's not part of their natural history, or that's not part of the natural environment. As a result of that, we're not getting a lot of big-time circulation up into that brain, particularly major pushes that result in major vascularization. And people can also be short of sleep. So between short of sleep, bad diet, minimal exercise throughout most of the course of people's second half of their lives, even after the brain was in beautiful condition when they were 30, it's starting to get into trouble by the time they're 50. So if you take a CAT scan of the average American when they're 50, you're going to see thousands of little tiny dots on that CAT scan. And what those are is they're little tiny miniature strokes. They're little embolisms. They're not hemorrhagic strokes. They're little tiny embolisms. Little tiny clots have been thrown from diseased arteries that have resulted in plugging up vessels in the brain. And so you're going to start to see cognitive decline as measured in IQ testing and specifically in memory testing. So you've done a big service to yourself, Scott, by getting your diet changed, and hopefully you get some good exercise down there in Arizona 12 months a year, and you get to sleep at a reasonable hour. And if you do all those things, I'm going to expect that you'll probably, have a fine mind for the whole ride. It's likely that would be the case. But with respect to this attentional issue, I think that's in fact nothing to do with memory processes per se. It has to do with the cost-benefit shifting of what's taking place in your life and what you're attending to behind that evaluation process.
Okay. Yeah, I appreciate
it. All right. Very good. Thank you for calling. Very good question.
Scott, thank you very much for the call and for staying on hold. Really appreciate it. Dr. Lyle, as always, we love the show. And talk to you, everybody, listeners. You guys have yourself a great new year. Dr. Lyle, have a wonderful new year celebration if you have one, or if
sure
you end up working, either
not
way.
Not much of one.
But,
yeah. All right, Nate. We'll see you all next year.
All right. Take care, everybody. Have a good night.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.